Hi, I'm Amelia Earhart. Right now, I'm only 10 years old, but I have already started planning my flying career. I relax by listening to Professor Buskill, Busmas, and take names. It's time to take in his super cool podcast.
Yes, it's Professor Buzzkill here, Bussing Myths, Taking Names. And once again, we have with us in the satellite office of the Buzzkill Institute, Professor Lisa Tatro from Carnegie Mellon University, who is back from last week. You came back. You were willing to come back after all this time.
I love the Buzzkill Society.
Well, it is Buzzkill Society, yes, is sort of magnetic. Professor, you did a show with us on the myth of Seneca Falls way back in the very, very beginnings of this podcast, but it was when we had a different format, a sort of goofy format. And people have been asking me, Buzzkillers have been asking me for years to have an in-depth discussion of the myth as well as the story of how all this happened. So, Professor, your book, The Myth of Seneca Falls, is very, very important in modern American history, and it's on the Buzzkill bookshelf, obviously. What did you mean by the myth of Seneca Falls?
So I meant to distinguish the story of Seneca Falls from the event of Seneca Falls, because those two things are two very separate things, but we often treat them as one.
Okay.
That the 1848 meeting in Seneca Falls, New York, was indeed the beginning of the suffrage movement, and was the beginning of, say, women's rights in the United States, or the beginning of feminism. And a lot of people push back against the idea that that is, in fact, the beginning. And one of the things I was curious about was where does that story come from? Because stories are not self-evident. They don't present themselves to people. There are not facts that then just say, this is the story we tell about those facts. So somebody had to create that story around that event. So my question was, where did that story come from?
Okay.
And what I found was that story becomes a story that kind of orders a suffrage world. And therefore, I call it a myth because it's such a powerful story that it gives order and meaning to a world.
Oh, like a Greek myth.
Like a Greek ancient myth. Exactly. Greek myth. So I meant less to call it false. It's not.
Right.
So a lot of times, and I think that was kind of frequent misunderstanding of my title is that I'm not saying Seneca Falls is false so much as I'm saying is it's a story and an event.
Right.
And we would do well to take the event and the story seriously as two separate things.
Okay. Now that's very fascinating because most people tend to jump at, oh, well, something must have happened, boom, at a start date, 1776, 1848,
right,
1941, whatever it is. We always seem to zero in exactly on a specific time. And usually specific people. And that's often not the case.
Right. So there was this meeting at Seneca Falls, and it might be useful for your listeners to just put that event in place for those people who aren't familiar with the event.
Let's explain that.
As the story goes, in 1848, a young Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who would go on to become Susan B. Anthony's best friend and co-agitator in the suffrage movement for the rest of her life, had just gotten married. She's living in Seneca Falls. Her husband has moved the family there. It's a little tiny hamlet in the Finger Lakes in western New York.
Very beautiful place.
Very beautiful place near the Erie Canal. And she is, like all young newlyweds in the 19th century, birthing a lot of babies and has a fairly robust domestic life as a result.
Sure.
Running a household, having kids. She's also a voracious intellect, and she is chafing a bit under all of this domestic labor and feeling a little isolated and run down. And a friend of hers, Lucretia Mott, comes through town. Lucretia Mott is a venerated elder abolitionist stateswoman who's coming through town with her sister, and they call on a couple of friends and have a tea party. The tea party takes place at Jane Hunt's house, and in the course of this tea party, as the story goes, Stanton pours out her domestic woes, and the women who've all already been touched by the women's rights agitation that's crossing the nation decide that right then and there that they're going to hold a women's rights convention.
Okay.
They do so in an impromptu fashion, so they only have a couple of days. They put an announcement in the local newspaper saying we will have this convention to discuss women's wrongs, and then they get busy in the intervening few days to write some sort of manifesto or script for what to do at this convention.
They do this just in a few days?
They do this just in a few
days.
That's
amazing.
Yep. Which is why a lot of people that we think of from this feminist abolitionist ferment of this era, this kind of anti-slavery women's rights activism, weren't there. because not because there weren't a lot of other women's rights activists, but because this is there were plenty of people out there speaking about women's rights prior to Seneca Falls.
I think buzzkillers might not understand that because of this origin problem starting a specific date, but there's a lot going on in the first half of the 19th century.
There's quite a bit going on, yes, yeah. Indeed. And it kind of comes together and coalesces in this 1848 moment, some people would argue. But the other thing is, a lot of the people who are active in that agitation already don't come mm-hmm. to Seneca Falls because yeah. it's a local impromptu convention and most people didn't even know it was taking place.
Right, and it's too far away for most people.
It's too far away from most people. You know, they didn't get word about it.
Yeah.
That fact that not a lot of people were there who were active in the movement becomes quite relevant, I think, to the creation of the story and why the story gets created, which we can right. talk about in a little bit.
Yeah.
The event is, you know, in the near offing, and Stanton and some other folks, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, some others, get together and start trying to write a document to organize the proceedings.
Mm-hmm.
And they end up hitting upon using the Declaration of Independence as their model. And they write something called the Declaration of Sentiments,
right, okay.
which is still to this day a very famous women's rights manifesto. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men, and then they alter it to add, and women are created equal.
Oh, they use the same, almost the same exact languages.
They use exactly the same language,
wow.
yes. But they alter it. And then instead of listing grievances against the king,
mm-hmm.
they list a bunch of grievances against man, right?
Right?
All of the ways in which he has deprived woman of equality and liberty.
Right.
And then at the end, they have a series of resolutions. I think there are 12 total. And those are all their demands. And they list a series of demands, one of which is the women's right to the elective franchise or women's voting.
Right. Some of which we talked about last week.
Yep.
We talked about women,
yep,
women
exactly.
and the right to vote. Right.
So many people date the beginning of the suffrage movement to 1848, but and many people date the beginning of women's rights to 1848, and many people date the beginning of feminism to 1848.
At least in the United States.
At least in the United States, yes, exactly.
But again, that's too stark, what you're saying, by saying it's, you know, it's too stark to say it starts in 1848. Things are going on beforehand as well.
It's too stark, and I think it also doesn't... My goal is twofold. One is to take down that idea that this is the beginning,
yeah.
the first
yeah,
call,
yeah, yeah.
and Stanton and Anthony are at the center of this story. But also, secondly, not to just take that down, but to also say we do ourselves a disservice if we don't take seriously looking at the story and the power of the story.
Right.
So I'm not just looking to unseat the story so much
yeah,
as
sure.
I'm looking to historicize the story and think about the power and the influence this story has had
mm-hmm.
and how it itself has been an actor in this unfolding campaign.
All right. The story itself becomes an actor later on in the century. Okay,
yeah. Stanton and Anthony really turn it into an actor itself.
Oh, right. Okay.
And so it's less to say Seneca Falls is false, because I don't think that's particularly helpful in and of
no.
itself. I think one of the things we need to understand
yeah.
is how and why this story has been so powerful and so encompassing and so voracious.
Okay,
that it has kind of eaten up, I think, a lot of other ways we could tell the story.
But how does the meeting go? They write the Declaration of Sentiments, and then presumably there's a discussion. Is there a debate? Is there
yep, they worry,
are resolutions passed?
Yep, they worry nobody will show up. And in fact, 300 people show up.
300?
300 people show up, which is pretty astonishing.
Yeah.
And already suggests the degree to which the country is primed to be discussing these issues, right?
Uh-huh.
Seneca Falls doesn't create that. Just some interesting details from the event. They worry that having a woman lead the event, this kind of co-ed event, will be too scandalous. So they have Lucretia Mott's husband, James, lead the event, or at least chair it.
Sounds amazing to us, 21st century.
Plenty of women yeah. speak from the stage. It's not that they silence
right,
women's
right,
voices.
Right.
But and they spend the 2 days discussing the Declaration of Sentiments
mm-hmm.
and the demands and the grievances therein. The resolutions, the 12 demands,
right.
all pass unanimously. The group votes on them. And they were things like women's equal wages, women's access to the professions, an end to the sexual double standard, women's property holding, a whole variety of things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, this is also a list of kind of white, middling class women's grievances.
Right.
And the ninth resolution, which is the right to vote, is the one that's hyper-controversial. It generates quite a bit of debate, and a lot of people want to vote it down. And then Frederick Douglass, the great emerging African-American statesman, who at this point is just getting his career underway as an abolitionist, happens to be there because he lives up in just north of Seneca Falls in Rochester.
Right.
So it was an easy trip down for him. He stands up and defends the resolution, and with that, it passes.
Wow.
So
I'm sure that's something a lot of people don't know.
Yeah. So Frederick Douglass was always and would remain for his entire lifetime a really ardent defender of women's suffrage and women's rights.
Can I just ask, why would a group discussing these sentiments and resolutions, why would anyone in that group be opposed to suffrage, women's voting?
That's a very interesting question. Well, and there are two competing...
You think they would all... That would be unanimous too.
Yep. And people had asked for the right to vote prior to this. Yeah, this is just the first organized meeting that kind of has it as a resolution. A lot of people say, oh, wow, that shows just how radical that idea was. It was so forward-thinking that people couldn't conceive of it. So that's a kind of common interpretation out there. I would say that's part of the function of the myth of Seneca Falls, that the myth of Seneca Falls tries to elevate the vote as the most radical and most important demand made. And the reason we now remember this moment at the Seneca Falls Convention as, oh, wow, that was really the most important demand made at Seneca Falls, is really the work of the Seneca Falls myth that's created later.
Okay.
We can talk about that in a minute. So most historians have since rejected that interpretation and argued instead that many of these people were Garrisonians, which is a certain type of abolitionism.
And who, this is William Henry, is who?
William Lloyd Garrison.
William Lloyd Garrison.
And that many Garrisonian abolitionists rejected politics because of its compliance with slavery, because the U.S. government supported and encouraged slavery, and so therefore they refused to participate in politics. So many people would argue today, historians would argue, the reason that this was so controversial is because for Garrisonians, politics was to be avoided and was to be boycotted.
So why were they opposed voting? I might have thought that maybe one reason is they fear they would alienate people who were otherwise sympathetic to them on the other points.
So the consensus among historians today is because for Garrisonian abolitionists, voting was in fact...
too political.
No. It wasn't too political. It was supporting slavery.
All right, because you're participating in the system, so
you're participating in the system, and they boycotted all things slave. Right. Like, they boycotted cotton, they boycotted sugar, they boycotted. And they're also boycotting American politics because they say it supports the institution of slavery.
Okay, Buzzkiller should remember that I'm a specialist in 19th century British history, and I should know this because I'm an American, but like everybody else,
I don't know this story
like I should.
But today, if kids learn anything about 19th century women's rights, they generally learn the story of Seneca Falls. Like,
right.
It is that... it is still a super powerful story.
So how does the story then start? How does it, if you will, leave Seneca Falls and start going, if maybe nationwide?
The word of the event travels nationwide, and it becomes quite celebrated that it has happened. It becomes quite mocked in many circles. After this, a lot of different locations, mostly across the Midwest and the Northeast, start holding women's rights conventions.
Right.
So there is a notable women's rights organizing and convention that flows from Seneca Falls. And with that is a coalescing women's rights movement that begins to hold national conventions where states send delegates and there's a national platform agreed upon. That starts in Worcester, Massachusetts in 1850.
Oh, so only 2 years later.
Yeah, only 2 years later. And for the next 10 years, roughly, up until the outbreak of the American Civil War, there will be national women's rights conventions held every year, almost. There's one year where they don't.
That sounds like a very big deal, yet you never hear about most people never hear about the 1850 Worcester convention.
Yep. And some people in the 19th century would have dated the beginning of women's rights to Worcester in 1850. Some people would have dated it to a different date. And for the most part, from what I can tell, people are not particularly concerned about where women's rights began.
Oh, that's interesting.
But they don't need an origin point for it because there's no need in the present to have an explanatory origin point. It's just not a relevant piece of understanding where they are and who they are.
And that's not uncommon with a lot of stories that become sort of mythologized.
So although Seneca Falls was known, it as the 1850s progress, its memory is sometimes forgotten by many or just never known by some.
Sure.
at one of the women's rights conventions in the 1850s, they decide they need a platform. Someone offers up the Seneca Falls resolutions, as you know, this has already been done, and the convention rejects them. It's like, no, that's not. Huh. So again, there's not this sense that we are all children of Seneca Falls, right? We are all, you know, that is our North Star. And then at the outbreak of the American Revolution, outbreak of the American Civil War in 1860, I found some statements in the newspapers where people are like, we don't really know where this women's rights movement came from. We have no idea, but it's here.
Yeah.
So again, so what I'm finding is that, for a long time, this story of Seneca Falls didn't exist.
At least a dozen years.
And then after the American Civil War, it still doesn't exist until Stanton and Anthony start creating it. The 1870s. And my argument in the book is that they start creating it for very specific political purposes, because the story is in fact a political weapon that they wield among many political weapons that both do battle outside the movement with the American public to try to persuade them to support women's suffrage, and does battle inside the movement where Stanton and Anthony are facing many obstacles and much dissent.
Okay, and that's an excellent place for us to take a little break for sponsorship, because this is where the story and the myth and all the other things we're talking about really start to take off. So we'll be back in a minute. Buzzkillers, I'm so totally stoked to take this little ad break and talk about our friends at The Great Courses Plus. They really tie the show together. You know, it seems like there's an infinite amount of information uploaded to the internet every day. But it's hard to know what's accurate. It's hard to know what's factual. It's hard to know what's believable. That's why I love having The Great Courses Plus. This is valuable, in-depth content I can trust, and I use it all the time. The streaming service offers thousands of objective, unbiased lectures from respected professionals who really know their stuff. You get unique, expert perspectives on topics ranging from history of American presidents to tips on effective reasoning, from critical business skills to learning how to cook, and much, much more. And now with the Great Courses Plus app, you can watch or listen anytime, anywhere. I've been enjoying the course, The Skeptic's Guide to American History. For instance, their episode on the myth of laissez-faire, and the other one that I like a lot is The Misconceptions About the Original Populace, both essential to help us understand American history. So stop second-guessing, Buzzkillers. Sign up for the Great Courses Plus today. I've arranged for you, Buzzkill Nation, to get a full month of unlimited access for free. To get your full month, sign up today using my special URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/buzzkill. Spell it all out, thegreatcoursesplus.com/buzzkill. Don't wait any longer. It's free. thegreatcoursesplus.com/buzzkill, and become enlightened. Okay, we're back, Buzzkillers, with Professor Lisa Tatro talking about the myth of Seneca Falls. Professor, when we left for the sponsorship break, we were talking about the post-Civil War period.
Yes.
So let's start there. But there are a couple of important figures we need to lay out. We need to tell the Buzzkillers and remind them who they are.
Yep.
Stanton and
Elizabeth Casey Stanton, we talked about. She's this young activist who gets settled in Seneca Falls, and she's the one who goes to the Tea Party that ends up launching the Seneca Falls meeting.
Right.
Many people would put Susan B. Anthony, her close coadjutor, there as well. That is part of the myth of Seneca Falls. She was, in fact, not there.
Susan B. Anthony.
Okay. Susan B. Anthony is a young school teacher up in Rochester, New York, up where Frederick Douglass lives. Okay. She's active in anti-slavery. She's active in temperance. So she is a reformer, but she won't make women's rights the center of her reform life until she meets Stanton in 1851. She'll go down, she'll be in Seneca Falls, and Amelia Bloomer will introduce the two in 1851. And they will, from that moment forward, be the best of allies. And really, you can't understand one's career without understanding the other.
Right.
So those two battle it out over the 1850s together. By the time we get to the post-war period, the late 1860s and the early 1870s, most of Stanton's kids are grown and out of the house. Uh-huh. And Stanton is able, therefore, to throw herself into reform work more robustly. And Anthony, meanwhile, never has kids and never marries. She's quite unusual in that regard in the 19th century. Yeah, and so the two of them really spend the post-Civil War years, and they won't die until the early 1900s, as dedicated and committed to this cause as their life's work.
Mm-hmm.
So there were plenty of people after the American Civil War that also began their activism in the pre-Civil War era.
Yeah.
And then after the American Civil War, also the movement recruits a whole bunch of new folks to it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So the movement after the war is it's a rapidly growing movement that has many of the pre-war figures in it with a lot of new figures in it as well.
Oh, okay.
The story of Seneca Falls is partly meant to give order to that kind of chaos in the personalities that are all competing for different positions within the movement.
Right. Which again is one of the things the sort of Greek myth version of a myth does. It gives order, explains the origins of things and how they happen. And
two things, I think, motivate Stanton and Anthony to start leveraging a story of Seneca Falls, to kind of invent and leverage a story of Seneca Falls after the war. And I should say that I don't think they're doing this out of a manipulative impulse. I think to them, this is really the way the world should be and the way the world is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they're frustrated that the rest of the world doesn't see it that way. And so they start marketing this story to the world, I think, less out of calculated manipulation so much as out of a sense that this is in fact the way the world should be.
Right.
But really what they're doing is inventing and marketing the story of Seneca Falls because it's their story and it orders the world as they understand it.
Right.
And they start using it because there are a variety of divisions inside the movement that put Stanton and Anthony at a defensive position. We think of them as the acclaimed, beloved leaders for the duration of the campaign, but that's really the end of the story read back onto the beginning. And we forget how they
create a lot too.
Yeah, how they created their leadership and how they had to vie for their leadership and how they were calculated, ambitious, and manipulative sometimes. Maybe not consciously, but and we often don't allow this of female politicians, right? We want female reformer politicians to be pure and egalitarian and these were ambitious politicians, and one of the things they did more successfully than any other women's rights activist in the 19th century, or really than any other suffragist, white suffragist, was leverage story as a political tool. And it has served them very well because they are still to this day some of the most remembered from this movement. And that's partly because of the work they themselves did to enshrine their story as the story.
Did using the story during the second half of the 19th century help accelerate? In other words, were they conscious of the fact that if we create this story, we can actually use it as a political tool? And did that happen? I mean, were there books written? And
they very consciously create this. They very,
I should say, they leverage it, like you say.
They very diligently create the story and market it. But again, I don't think they're doing so in order to get people. I think what they're doing is they're trying to shape the course of history according to what they think it needs to be.
Right.
And they very successfully do that. So maybe going back to the post-war period and thinking about the kinds of trouble they were in and the ways in which they found themselves on the defensive and how they then used this story to kind of rescue their reputations and their role, I think is maybe a good place to go here.
Yeah.
After the American Civil War, the Feminist Abolitionist Coalition from the pre-war period reorganizes into the American Equal Rights Association. The American Equal Rights Association makes two demands on the American government. One is voting for black men who were recently emancipated across the South.
Right.
And voting for women, white and black women also just having been recently emancipated across the South.
Okay.
Fast forward a couple of years, the federal government only grants black male voting.
Right.
And as the federal government grants black male voting in the 15th Amendment, the American Equal Rights Association takes up the question of how do we throw our support behind this amendment, because this is part of what we want. Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton balk. They say, no way, we refuse to support this. And they engage in some pretty racist arguments with Frederick Douglass, who had, of course, been the supporter of voting at Seneca Falls. They do not now support his voting. And they bolt from the American Equal Rights Association and form something called the National Woman Suffrage Association, which is dedicated to the defeat of the 15th Amendment and then the creation of a 16th Amendment, which would be a woman suffrage amendment. That's the origin of the suffrage amendment. In the antebellum period, people hadn't argued for an amendment.
Okay.
So as we talked about in the last show.
Sure.
So their feminist abolitionist allies are astonished. And really chagrined that Stanton and Anthony would take such a hostile position to Black men's civil rights in an era where vigilante violence was threatening and taking their lives on a daily, hourly basis. Yeah. So Stanton and Anthony are already in a little bit of trouble with their allies. And then the rest of the folks in the American Equal Rights Association reorganizes the American Woman Suffrage Association. So immediately from 1870 forward, the movement is born divided.
Right.
There's an effort.
The names sound very similar. And
the National and the American. Yeah. And the American is led by this woman named Lucy Stone, who's hugely important. Yeah. Had been lecturing on women's rights in 1847, a full year before Seneca Falls.
Mm-hmm.
Will lead the American, for the rest of her life. Will run a newspaper called the Woman's Journal, which will be the central organ of the campaign for most of its life. And
she's overlooked.
She's completely overlooked. And part of it is because of this myth making. She was not part of that myth story. And she herself never spent any time trying to write her own history because her attitude was, and when Stanton and Anthony started writing history, she said, "We don't have time for this. We have work to do. This history isn't over yet. We can't write it."
Not a bad argument.
Although she sabotaged herself because to this day, she's not remembered.
Oh, well, that's true.
And one of the things her daughter would say in the aftermath of her death and in the aftermath of the 19th Amendment, where her mother's memory was so forgotten, was we made a big mistake by not attending to memory or not attending to history.
Right.
So even after this, many of the people who lost out in the myth of Seneca Falls would realize that they had been outmaneuvered in the remembering of this campaign.
Okay. So let's remind the Buzzkills where we are chronologically as the story is being fashioned and promoted.
So there's this division. Now, okay.
And the division happens in...
There's this division in 1870.
Oh, 1870. Okay.
Yep. 1869, 1870.
Right.
The story of Seneca Falls still does not exist. I mean, the event exists and mention it, but like as a codified story with certain features and a kind of routine pattern in how it's told and all of that, which it is today, that doesn't exist yet.
Yeah.
And many people who are pouring into the campaign as new recruits don't know anything about the pre-war campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So there's another thing going on. There's this division, but there's also this battle that women's rights advocates have in foregrounding their cause as something that also gets passed along with Black suffrage, along with Black male suffrage.
Right.
So one of the things to remember after the American Civil War period is that this is a period of intense memory building in the United States. This is not unique to the suffrage movement. And one of the things that happens to support Black male rights is this remembering of abolition and of the anti-slavery campaign as the greatest reform that has ever happened on the face of the earth,
This
is the most momentous historical unfolding of human rights that has ever happened.
Right.
There's much sort of said about the majesty of this moment, and that sense of historical mission undergirds many of the granting of rights to Black men.
Mm-hmm.
So what I argue is that one of the things Stanton and Anthony do and other suffragists do is start creating their own memory. They say, hey, because one of the things that white abolitionist men say to these women is, this is the Negro's hour, you need to wait, right? This is the Negro's hour, you need to wait. So in 1870, one of the other things that happens is they hold their first anniversary convention, their first like historical convention where they say, you know, we began here. But what's interesting in 1870 is they don't use Seneca Falls. They use Worcester in 1870.
Oh, because it would be the 20th.
Right. So it's a 20th anniversary.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And they start doing some of the same things they will eventually do with the Seneca Falls story, arguing, for example, that the women's rights movement. So they make basically two arguments. One is we've been around for a long time, right? We are not new. Therefore, we also deserve rights in the present because we've been asking this for a super long time. So that's one of the origins of looking back, or one of the strategies of looking backward, I would argue, is arguing we've been around for a while. It's our turn too.
Mm-hmm.
This is also the woman's hour. And B, they start arguing things like, they start calling the women's rights movement the greatest movement that humanity has ever inaugurated.
Right.
Which is clearly meant to undercut the argument that abolition is that, right? That we are the greatest movement for humanity.
Yeah.
And so it's this kind of argument that our memory matters more in the present than theirs. Therefore, we should get rights as opposed to them.
Right.
So there start being this way in which they're competing with the abolitionist memory and present by trying to create a women's rights memory to leverage rights. But I argue that as the division inside the movement gets deeper, Worcester doesn't work anymore for Stanton and Anthony, who are one of the ones who organized the Worcester Convention, the Worcester Anniversary Convention in 1870, because they hadn't been at Worcester in 1850. Okay. Neither one of them had been there. Yeah. But who had been there was their arch rival, Lucy Stone. She was there in 1850, goodness. And she boycotts the 1870 Anniversary Convention.
Could this get any more complicated?
I know, it's very complicated. So as the movement inside among the activists gets deeper and gets more heated, which happens over the rest of the 1870s, Stanton and Anthony realize they need a story that excludes their rivals and centers them. And I don't know to what degree they consciously realize this.
Well, let's tell a little bit of the story of that division.
Yeah, it's a fun story. And there needs to be a biopic made of some of this. There's a woman who arrives on the scene named Victoria Woodhull. Mm-hmm. Victoria Woodhull is a clairvoyant, which is someone who can talk to the dead, which many people in the 19th century believed certain people possessed the ability to do. She's a kind of free lover, a sex radical. She's an overall radical. Her sister, Tennessee Claflin, walks around in men's clothing and smokes cigars and has short-cut hair. And this is an era when you didn't do this. They arrive in New York City sort of as, you know, ordinary folks, but they come to the attention of Cornelius Vanderbilt, because Vanderbilt has recently lost a loved one, wants to be in touch with that loved one because that loved one is dead. Victoria Woodhull puts him in touch with the dead relative. He is super grateful and showers the sisters with a ton of cash. They open the first Wall Street brokerage firm. Victoria Woodhull gets invited by a congressional committee to come talk about women's suffrage, right? Like,
wow.
She sort of just catapults to the foreground of this reform movement. And Stanton and Anthony are like, well, we got to be there for this, right?
Exactly.
So they show up at this congressional hearing, and they're really smitten with Victoria Woodhull. They invite her to their convention, and they start advocating a new idea, which is that the existing Constitution already enfranchises women. So they abandon the 16th Amendment campaign and they just say, you know what? We're going to just go straight for suffrage. We're just going to go vote and test our argument in courts that the Constitution already enfranchises us. This takes them into 1872. 1872, a bunch of women go vote in the presidential election, a couple hundred. One of them will take their way all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. And in that decision, Minor v. Happersett, the court will strike down this argument and go back to the episode, you know, that we did just before this.
We'll
harken back and they will say, no, voting is a privilege of citizenship. It is not a right. Therefore, as citizens, you are not invested with the right to vote. Your argument about the Constitution is false. The Constitution contains no right to vote. Mm-hmm. So that argument gets struck down. So their strategy struck down. But then in the meanwhile, there's also this other stuff that Victoria Woodhull unfolds that digs Stan and Anthony into a kind of deeper hole with Lucy Stone and their allies. Victoria Woodhull, being a kind of bomb thrower, she's also a free lover. She's a sex radical of the 19th century. Yeah. Henry Ward Beecher, who is the nation's leading minister, and many people would know him as the brother of Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, is the president of the American Woman Suffrage Association for a time, right? The Stanton and Anthony rival organization. And he refuses to appear on a stage with Victoria Woodhull because she's, of course, a licentious, evil, immoral, retrograde. She knows, meanwhile, that he's having an affair with his best friend's wife and perhaps with many of his parishioners. She's like, you hypocrite.
Yeah, right? Exactly, yeah.
So she decides to just out the dude on the cover of her newspaper, which she has started with money that she got from Cornelius Vanderbilt, called the Woodhull and Claflin's Weekly.
Wow.
She outs his adulterous affair, setting off one of, you know, the famous sex trials of the 19th century. Henry Ward Beecher is, you know, put on trial for
huge
adultery.
Scandal.
She's jailed for obscenity, for having published this obscene, you know, account in her journal, blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, Stanton goes on and affirms that, in fact, she is the source for this. And Stanton and Anthony, because Woodhull is at this point associated with their organization, end up taking a lot of the hit for bringing this kind of sex scandal into the suffrage movement. And not only that, Victoria Woodhull in 1872, I mean, she's a crazy character, also decides that she's going to run for president. She's the first woman to ever run for president. She declares herself a candidate for president. she's jailed, you know, around the election time. I mean, it's, you know, it's chaos. But the fallout of all of this on the backside of 1873, as you kind of, you know, get through 1872 mm-hmm, into 1873, is that many people now start saying, oh my gosh, the suffrage movement is nothing but a bunch of immoral free lovers who are, you know, hell-bent on...
Tarred with the brush of,
you know, so this brush with Victoria Woodhull turns out to be quite a PR disaster. And Victoria Woodhull herself is... turned into a cartoon by Thomas Nast as Mrs. Satan. And she's eventually chafed out of the United States. I mean, the attack on her is so great. She will live the rest of her life in England. The importance of this for the story of Seneca Falls, I would argue, is that both their strategy is defeated and they have tons of bad PR. And many people, for Stanton and Anthony, right? Yeah. And many people inside the movement, Lucy Stone and the American, are just aghast at what Stanton and Anthony are up to. They're like... they are going to destroy this moment of opportunity because many people see in the 1870s that women's suffrage can actually win. Yeah. Many people believe it will win. 1873 dawns, right? It's now January 1873, and like it's bad news for Stan and Anthony. Mm-hmm. And they have their January convention because they always have a January convention. And interestingly, they hold the first anniversary convention for Seneca Falls that meeting.
1873.
The 25th anniversary convention for Seneca Falls. It's the first anniversary convention for Seneca Falls that I've ever found. No one is celebrating the anniversary of Seneca Falls until this moment. And, you know, who knows exactly how this got started? Who knows? In some ways, they had nothing to look forward to, so maybe looking backward was their only option. It was convenient that it was 1873, so it was 25 years.
Oh, right, yeah.
But at this convention, this first Seneca Falls convention, you see them from the stage educating the audience about what Seneca Falls was. I mean, you get the sense that this is a story they have to explain to an audience. And so they start telling the Seneca Falls story really in a kind of what will become a very predictable storyline for the first time, really. And they say, you know, you should know. And they start telling people about this story.
Mm-hmm. Is this a way to purify the movement of the Woodhull stain? You know what I'm saying? If we show this older origin with purer women, we might be able to avoid this scandal.
I think it does that. I think it also does a couple other things, which is vindicate Stan and Anthony. So they tell this story. They reprint the proceedings from Seneca Falls in 1870 or earlier. So now those proceedings are circulating. So they have a kind of documentary basis. They're sort of saying to people, get your hands on these proceedings so that you can read them, so that you can appreciate the glory that was 1848. It won't really be clear how this story is going to work until slightly later. But one of the things that I think we can say kind of in retrospect that this story does is narrow origins to Stanton. And by implication, to Anthony.
Okay.
And therefore, it looks like they are the founders of feminism. And if they are the founders of feminism, then anything that they do must be true and proper.
Yeah.
And anything that anyone else does must not be true and proper. So it's a way of starting to argue that their decisions are, in fact, sound and just. Because they are, in fact, the origins of the movement. And so anything they do is, by definition, the proper path of feminism. Whereas as they tell this story of Seneca Falls, all their rivals aren't there.
Yeah. Huh.
So already they're sort of historically excluding them without resorting to outright exclusion. But just by telling the story of Seneca Falls, they exclude all their rivals as relevant to the origins of feminism.
Absolutely fascinating. Well, Buzzkillers, let's take a quick, special, very special station ID break. And we'll be back in a moment to talk about the rest of the 19th century and the early 20th century.
Hello, this is I, Buzzkill. Niece of Professor and one of many Buzzlings in the extended Buzzkill family. Loyal Buzzkillers can help support the show by going to ProfessorBuzzkill.com and clicking on Support the Show button. For as little as $1 per month, you can join Buzzkill Society and keep it alive. Check it all out by going to ProfessorBuzzkill.com and clicking on the Support the Show button. And don't forget to follow us on social media and invite Professor Buzzkill to come speak to your group. All the links are on the website. Oh, and one final thing, Buzzkillers, you should know that my uncle is a boomer, but his heart's in the right place.
Okay, we're back, Buzzkillers. Now, Professor, we left this in 1873 in the presentation of this story. What proceeds from there?
After that, Stanton and Anthony spend a lot of time telling this story. And it becomes more and more kind of codified and solidified and has a clear story structure and always kind of told the same way and always has kind of the same lessons. And they will, like I said, they will be attentive to the historical power of memory and storytelling and in history, really, in a way that no other suffragists in this era, white suffragists anywhere, were nearly as savvy about. They will go on and continue to hold anniversary conventions for Seneca Falls, but then also start to write a participant history of the movement. And they'll spend, they think they're going to do it in 1 year and it'll be one volume. But of course, as all of us who write history know, it never turns out to be that easy.
We're paid by the word.
So they end up spending 10 years and writing three volumes
of
this. It takes 10 years of their life while they're also doing activism.
Yeah.
You know, it is just unbelievable, arduous labor.
Yeah.
There's
no
women's history archive to go consult. They have to, write people and ask for their letters. They have to try to reconstruct the history over decades. It's really, and it is in many ways a Valentine to the movement, and still is, in, you know, to this day, a really, in many ways, sacred and beautiful document.
Yeah.
Because they were arguing at the time that women's history mattered, and that if women were going to matter in history, we also had to have some sense that they had a history.
Yeah.
You know, and so theirs was a very modern impulse in many ways, that for a group to have power in the present, they also had to have a past. Which is why we have women's history today and African-American history and queer history. And they felt very strongly that they started to realize the movement might outlive them.
Yeah.
And that movement needed a sense of who it was and what it was.
And is that then, how does that become presented or published, or how does it?
So they and Matilda Jocelyn Gage, who was another New York suffragist, the three of them, end up working on this on and off over 10 years. And they published three massive volumes of 1,000 pages each.
1,000 pages each.
1,000 pages each. And just so you get a sense of how radical this was to be writing women's history at all, Anthony will, at the conclusion of this, send copies to libraries all around the world and all around the country in particular. And Harvard will, in fact, return the volumes,
saying
that this is not worthy of its shelves. This is not a history that merits remembering or that matters.
Astounding.
So that itself, I think, just speaks. And what I'm trying to do is, before I talk about the problems with this, project, also recognize just how important and powerful it was to do this in a positive sense. But of course, anytime someone writes history, they're also writing a partial account and writing and they tell this story as they see it. And that is with themselves at the center, which is in some ways not surprising.
No.
Many historical figures who think they matter, center themselves.
Yeah. Happens all the time.
So they center themselves, and they center the story of Seneca Falls as kind of the origins of all of this. And then from that, Stanton and Anthony really both lead, direct, and define the campaign.
Okay, so we're now into the 1880s. Is that right?
So the last volume, the first volume is published in 1881, the last volume in 1886. And they do a variety of interesting things in these volumes. Not only do they center themselves, but Seneca Falls authorizes them as leaders in many ways.
Oh, okay.
And of course, they never claim Anthony was there. But very, very quickly, Anthony, because she leads all the anniversary meetings, she stands on the stage and directs these anniversary meetings. So she appears to be, this is our story, this is my story. And then a couple of really interesting things happen in some of the early versions of this thing is, like, Stanton will have, for example, a chapter on Susan B. Anthony where she talks about Susan B. Anthony. And she, to introduce her to the story.
Yeah.
And she'll make it sound like they met in 1848. Like she'll say, I met this woman who was meant to be, destined to be great in our cause in 1848. And, other suffragists will write in and say, this is false. How can you claim such a thing? And one of the things about Stanton is Anthony would always say about her, she could tangle up her chronology to beat anybody.
But
you can imagine that in Stanton's mind, she might have met Anthony. Who can remember? I can't remember what happened 3 years ago, So I don't necessarily say, again, this was manipulative, again, so much as this was their worldview.
Right. I think it's
moving forward, Anthony would become tightly associated with us to the point that many people thought Anthony was at Seneca Falls. And still to this day, many people think Anthony's at Seneca Falls. But some of the other things they do, okay, so they kind of put Anthony, so that you've got Stanton and Anthony as the origin of the movement, therefore the official representation. They are the rightful heirs and the rightful leaders of feminism at a time when their leadership is hotly contested.
Right.
So I think the story serves that purpose. And really, they win with that story. I think it helps them.
Sure.
They eventually defeat Lucy Stone's organization in 1890. They basically kill that organization. Lucy Stone dies shortly thereafter. And Anthony will very undemocratically take over the head of the National American Woman Suffrage Association, which will go on until the victory. So in that sense, I think they're quite successful.
Yeah.
In another sense, what they do is they describe in this volume, they say in 1869, which is the 15th Amendment split, there was a secession in our ranks. This is the language
they use. The word secession?
They use the word secession, which you do not use lightly in the aftermath of the American Civil War, right?
No.
There was a secession in our ranks, when in fact it was Stanton and Anthony who broke away from the group.
Cow,
but in this sense, we center Stanton and Anthony again, right? Because they are Seneca Falls. Anyone who deviates from them deviates from the movement, when in fact it was Stanton and Anthony really who broke away from the movement. So they say there was a secession in our ranks. They call their rivals secessionists, which again centers them as the center of the story, and you know, the ones who are really the rightful understand. And when they remember Seneca Falls, they mostly just remember the right to vote. Remember, there were a whole bunch of demands
other
made at Seneca Falls,
yeah,
but they
yeah.
center the vote. And part of the reason they do that is after the American Civil War, there's a big argument within women's politics about what ought to be the center of a women's rights movement. And many people argue the vote is not really the you know, be all and end all of reform or what women need. So Stanton and Anthony are also arguing with temperance advocates and birth control advocates and like other people who are arguing, you know, my bodily safety is my number one issue.
Sure.
Like the vote is not my number one issue. So they're also using Seneca Falls to try to center the vote as the most important of all women's reforms, to argue against other women's rights activists in the era that this is the thing we need to pay most attention to.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So it serves all these different purposes. And then it also serves the purpose that the original Worcester Convention had served, which is they make claims that this is the most important movement that humanity has ever inaugurated.
Yeah.
You know, we have this long history. It is our time.
Right.
So telling history also in this sense is about claiming this is our time. It, you know, don't tell us to wait. This is too soon. We've been at this forever. We have a deep and long history. Therefore, the time is now. So it's an argument also for rights. And then lastly, it's meant as a resource for the campaign itself so that those women know the long traditions from which they've come as a way to help motivate them going forward.
Yeah. So how, I mean, we keep saying that this is time. Well, they keep saying this is time. It's time. It's been a long time coming. Throughout the 1890s and into the early decade of the first decade of the 20th century, are they using Seneca Falls to push for what becomes the eventual amendment?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, much in the way that but one thing I should point out is this is not unique to the suffrage movement.
Okay.
One thing I think we don't pay close enough attention to is how social movements use stories or history to organize themselves, to create hierarchy within them, to try to focus people on certain goals, to try
Sacred
to motivate
text.
People, to try to keep people focused.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, the story of Seneca Falls and the story of the past becomes very important to people looking forward. It becomes a kind of North Star. And it also centers Stanton and Anthony in really important ways. I argue that by the end of their lives, they really are the kind of overall leaders of this campaign. But there's still lots of dissent from their leadership.
That's amazing,
And so we forget that. We just treat them as if everyone loved them and fell in line behind them. And that leaders have to constantly retain their power. And that is a tricky and messy business. And history was part of how Anthony in particular maintained and built her power inside the movement. It was not just given to her freely because she was just so wonderful. I mean, you know, some people may have come to that conclusion, but, you know, it's more than that.
And when you say by the end of their lives, what years are we talking about now?
By the 1890s, and one of the things that happens, part of the reason I argue we still to this day most easily equate Anthony with Seneca Falls and we forget Stanton is that in the 1890s, a couple of things happen. These women are now geriatric.
Mm-hmm.
Anthony still has robust appetizing for organizing. She takes over the presidency of the National American, the new unified organization.
Right.
And Stanton, frankly, always hated conventions to begin with. She's a philosopher. She's not much of an organizer. And she's like, screw this. I've had enough. I'm old. You know, it's hard for me to get around. Right. I hated conventions to begin with. I'm not going to anymore.
Yeah.
So she basically just kind of absents herself from the movement. And for a long time, it had been Anthony who'd said, you have to come to the convention, and kind of drug her there. But now she's like, you know what? I'm in my old age. I can do what I want.
Sure.
There's that. So she starts to just kind of remove herself from the campaign in the sense that she's not as visible to mm-hmm. people going forward. And then secondly, she ends up writing, she decides that Christianity is really the root of all evil, or at least men's bastardization of Christianity is the root of all evil. So she writes the Woman's Bible, which is a feminist critique of the Bible.
Yes.
And basically says men have perverted scripture in order to dominate and control women. And this absolutely inflames a whole lot of Christian women inside the suffrage movement, which is at this point quite a big organization, like a really big umbrella group, because the Women's Christian Temperance Union, which was the largest organization of women in the 19th century, has also now pledged itself to suffrage. So you've got the Women's Christian Temperance Union as really one of the largest constituents in the broader suffrage umbrella. And Stanton is just excommunicated at this point from the movement. There is an excommunication vote taken where she is basically severed.
An actual vote.
Yeah, no, there's an actual vote. And she is voted out of the movement, essentially, by these... Anthony will not resign. So Stanton fully expects that Anthony will resign her position, and she does not. She remains sort of... So a variety of things happen such that going forward, Anthony is the one who continues to be centered and remembered, along with Seneca Falls, such that the two, while they had been conflated over her lifetime, by the 1890s become very tightly conflated. And it's really Anthony going forward who will stand on stages and hold anniversary conventions for Seneca Falls.
Okay.
And she and Seneca Falls just become synonymous in many ways. And Stanton, who had actually been there, drops out of the story. And at the end, and then they both die in the early 1900s. Stanton dies first in 1902. And Anthony dies in 1906. And when Anthony dies in 1906, her obituaries were almost uniformly say she founded the women's movement at Seneca Falls in 1848.
Wow.
She wrote the Declaration of Sentiments.
It's not surprising that people believe this because it was printed.
Yeah. So you still see the myth repeated all the time today. And, you know, Stanton's kids are just incensed because much like Lucy Stone's daughter, who's incensed that history has forgotten their mother, they're incensed that history has forgotten their mother. And they're giving Anthony credit for Seneca Falls when, in fact, it's their mother who inaugurated it. So they start writing competing stories in the New York Times saying Miss Anthony had nothing to do with Seneca Falls. Stanton's son, Theodore, will say Miss Anthony had no more to do with Seneca Falls than the man on the moon.
Right.
You know, trying to correct this. But the myth has gone forward, and this story has remained incredibly powerful. And it has done a number of things, I would say, in our continual allegiance to it.
Right.
I think it served a whole variety of purposes in the 19th century and has served a whole variety of purposes in the 20th century.
So let's talk about the varieties of the way it was used in the 20th century, particularly after the 19th Amendment.
Yeah. So although this isn't an area I've spent a whole lot of time researching directly, there are a variety of things that are just evident once you kind of see the power of the story. It becomes the anchor for the 1920 victory. And one of the things it does is help 1920 seem like it's a final victory point when, in fact, it's a very partial victory point.
Right, of course, as we talked about last week.
That's right. So all of a sudden now you get this very tight chronology after 1920, which is 1848 to 1920
as this nice packaged
bookend, neat story that we can tell to celebrate the victory.
That happens so often.
And we still are really struggling, I think, to undo the tightness of that narrative. And I think the power of the Seneca Falls myth or of the story has been partly to give us this, you know, what people would call first wave feminism as equaling the vote and equaling 1848 to 1920, which is problematic in all kinds of ways. A, there were all kinds of other right campaigns in the 19th century that were not around the vote. B, 1848 to 1920 doesn't capture important dates for many women's organizing around the vote, including many women of color. And men and women, people weren't voting after 1920. So, I mean, there's just a variety of ways in which 1848 to 1920 does us a great disservice in terms of seeing the complexity of this history, seeing the variety of people involved. But what it does do is really reinscribe a story that Stanton and Anthony wanted us to remember. And wow, have we remembered it.
People put stickers.
It's still very hard to unseat.
Yeah, every election we see the I voted stickers placed on Susan B.
Yeah, that's gravestone. A relatively recent phenomenon, but yes, yeah.
And I don't see on Facebook anyway.
Yeah.
People putting stickers on Stanton's grave or Lucy Stone's grave or maybe.
No, I mean, one of the things, okay, so a bunch of other stuff happens moving forward too, before 1920, the suffrage movement splits again. Because of course social movements are messy enterprises. So after Anthony dies, there'll be a young upstart inside the National American, which is now headed by Carrie Chapman Catt. And this new upstart will be Alice Paul, will argue for a militant campaign instead of a kind of cultivating the favor of politicians, you know, just kind of stick it to them, like be in their face. And she breaks and forms the National Woman's Party, engages in all kinds of direct action tactics, picketing the White House, blah, blah, blah. Whereas Carrie Chapman Catt is trying to slowly cultivate the favor of politicians and not alienate them. And so they hate each other. Well, how do they each argument that they are, in fact, the legitimate approach? They each argue they are the heirs of Susan B. Anthony, right? Who is at this point the one that you'd want to remember. You wouldn't argue.
You don't want to be the heir.
You don't want to be the heir of Stanton, right? Lord, not in this era, right? Because she comes with all kinds of problems.
Yeah.
So, you know, part of the way Anthony further gets centered is that lots of suffragists after Anthony's death are using Anthony to argue for their own legitimacy. And that further tightens the story of Anthony and Seneca Falls.
Mm-hmm.
So you get this kind of overlay of mythology around Anthony. And then moving forward, as people try to argue for women's rights moving forward, one of the easy ways to do that is the same argument that Stanton and Anthony made. One, we've had a history, right?
Yeah. And now it's
back,
in 3,000 pages of
volumes. And not only that, right? So moving forward into the history, as women, particularly white women, try to recover their own history, there aren't a whole lot of women's history books, but there is the history of woman suffrage that Stanton and Anthony wrote. And not only that, the movement will go on to add additional volumes to that. It will end up being a six-volume study that will conclude in 1920. And it will be six volumes. And so, you know, there's this ready-made story. There's this ready-made history for people moving forward that continues to center that as the story for white women. And, of course, many women of color would say, that story has nothing to do with me. Because it doesn't. And it was sort of designed not to, right?
Oh,
I mean, it was designed to center white women, and it has continued to do that. So people will ask the question to try to rescue Seneca Falls, well, were there any women of color there? And of course, that's an important question. And the answer is, we don't know. There may have been, but we really don't know if there were any. But there were plenty of women of color in organizing moving forward.
Absolutely.
But women of color were also organizing in all kinds of other ways and around all kinds of other coalitions and in all kinds of other spaces. And that history has to be included as well. We can't allow the story of Seneca Falls to continue to define the suffrage story, because we continue to privilege white women every time we continue to retell this story. And we have to break up this chronology if we are going to tell the story, for example, of all the women who didn't vote after 1920.
Well, Buzzkillers, we usually end the show by saying something like, well, there you have it, Buzzkillers. But what we've presented in this show is how complicated these things are and how many strands there are. And it's not there you have it. It's there we need to continue to go. So please go out and volunteer for your local historical association and try to help dig up more info and more great historical figures who are unknown and lesser known, should be better known. And it just remains for me to thank Professor Tatro for talking to us and explaining all this today. And of course, your book, Myth of Seneca Falls, is on the Buzzkill bookshelf.
Excellent. Thank you.
And we hope that you'll come back again for other shows.
Always, always, always welcome a chance to chat with Professor Buzzkill.
Okay, Buzzkillers, we'll talk to you next week.